This is WRUULP Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul. Coming up next, Art on the Air with your host, Rob Hessler. Welcome to Art on the Air with your host, Rob Hessler. This is an hour-long interview show dedicated to the visual arts. Each week we feature guests in conversation about their theory, practice, and current projects, as well as the state of the visual arts in our community. We feature long-form sit-down interviews, as well as on-location field notes about specific events. So let's get started with another episode of Art on the Air. Here's your host, Rob Hessler.
And this is Rob Hessler. Thanks again for tuning in to Art on the Air. I am joined once again with my wife, Gretchen Hilmers. Hey, Gretch.
Yeah, I wish you would do the intro like Wayne and Garth, with me as always. Can you just start doing that?
I don't know what are you talking about? You Wayne know, and Garth?
In the Wayne's world, where he's like, with me as always.
With me as always is Gretchen Hilmers. Is that it?
I don't know. We'll have to work on this.
I mean, seriously,
it
we need to work.
Into my head.
Really, bring this up before we go on the air. Anyway, we're getting into...
I might be totally wrong, too. Probably.
You heard it here first, folks. Gretchen admitted that she was wrong. This week's episode is awesome. A long, long interview with Katie Glusica. She is a weaver, somebody who does drawings. She's a scientist. And we had an awesome conversation. We talked all about her work, which is steeped in particle wave duality.
Say that three times fast.
I know, seriously. We talked about her interest in restoration and sort of the philosophy behind all of that, which was really amazing. And then we also got a little bit of a bonus part of the recording that we're going to play in the second half of the show, where we talked about her organizational techniques. And Gretchen and I are going to actually talk a little bit about organization there at the end of the show. But yeah, looking forward to playing that interview with her. Now, Gretchen, you weren't here for this one, but you have seen her work before. We saw this at her exhibition, Drawing Connections.
Yes. I was so pregnant at the time.
So her exhibition was, she did an exhibition with Deborah First at the Drawing Room.
That was amazing.
Yeah, up on 41st Street in Starland. I fell in love with her work, and she's been kind of on my list of somebody that I really wanted to have a longer conversation with. And so finally, you know, got a hold of her, and it's just such a great conversation. I had to cut some out because it's just... it did go a little bit longer, but I mean, I wanted to nerd out on it even more if I'm being real. It was like we were really getting into the science stuff. But anyway, I think you're really going to enjoy it. And, you know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Katie's work, but this is a great opportunity for you to get familiar with what she's doing. So why don't we dive right into it? Again, this is Katie Glusica. She is a weaver whose work is very deeply steeped in science. Enjoy. Rob Hessler here with Art on the Air Field Notes. I am speaking by telephone with Katie Glusica. Katie, first and foremost, I kind of want to dive right into, because you're a fiber artist, but you describe yourself as a weaver, and I want to get into the details of that. But one of the things I find fascinating about you and your work is how it has some connection to science and scientific practices. And I was doing some research about you, and I learned that you were actually much more interested in science when you were very young, and you didn't really actually get into art until later in high school, and then finally in college, you really kind of bought all in. So science has kind of stuck with you. Talk a little bit about your sort of scientific background, first and foremost, before we get into talking about your art.
Okay, thank you for having me, Bob, firstly. And yeah, that is kind of one of my more favorite stories about my trajectory, just that I wasn't that aware of my interest in art until later, but always very driven in science. So by the time I got to Savannah in grad school, actually, let me back up. I think this really started to come together for me as an undergrad when I got into the crafts department at the Virginia Commonwealth University, which was a very fortunate thing to have come across. And crafts, generally defined as glass, ceramics, woodworking, metals, textiles. And I took a structural textile course my first semester in the department, and then got also very fond of glass blowing and casting. And at that same time, because when you're in college at like the public university I was taking, and there was a lot of freedom with what electives I could take. And I think it really started clicking for me when I was in a biology class at the same time as really getting into becoming more of an artist, and particularly weaving. And thinking about, it was a particular thing that was just biology 101, but thinking a lot about, I got pretty obsessed with the general right brain, left brain concept, and not that the brain really breaks down like that and like what parts of it work on these things. It's very complex and we learn more every day, but you know, that my sister, she went into science, but was growing up much more kind of wild, I'd even say, and more creative naturally in some instances, where I'm very more analytical by nature. And so, you know, so I started thinking about that, like what makes people gravitate towards different things. And I think of both my sister and I cases, which really is how I came to it, was like coming across this thing that's a little less natural to you, so it's a little more challenging and engaging. And so after kind of, you know, really plunging into the art and then taking this biology class at the same time, there was all this cross-pollination going on between looking at like the diagrams and thinking about just the, you know, majesty of the natural world, especially getting smaller and smaller, you know, cellular diagrams. That was probably one of the first things I started using as a form in some of my artwork in the craft department, referencing biologic things. And I also have a kind of a very pretty rare and serious autoimmune disease. I don't always talk about that, but it really does play a lot into curiosity about how all the little tiny systems around us all work. And really that relates directly to fibers, which is how the department is called at SCAD, which is a high level way of thinking as a field of a collection of processes that take lots and lots and lots of little tiny things and accumulate them and organize them into these larger structures, which is also kind of how life is built. And so I see all these like very natural overlaps there. And the more I started thinking about it in the department and how my brain was so happy weaving and working in glass and doing things with my hand and feeling very technically with things, and sort of realizing like that through craft processes like weaving that uses a ton of mathematics, even though it's not math always the way, you can be very bad at paper arithmetic and be a really great weaver, but you're still using mathematics, you're just using it in a more intuitive kind of a way, I guess you would say. You know, so as I was starting to have to like really think about my artist statement and the way I thought of what I was making and how I was making, I started directly correlating my weaving class with my like being a math class, and I would kind of not joke with my teachers that weaving was my math class and physics glass blowing was my physics class. It ended up coming full circle in grad school, and I related physics and weaving metaphorically. And then there's like another piece that sort of right brain, left brain, one sibling goes into science and one sibling goes into art, that when I got to grad school, my sister was getting married and she married a guy who was also in science. And he had one brother, and his brother was in art. And I had a very close friend who I went to weaving school with, and their sister, they have one sister, and their sister is a scientist and they're an artist. And then my roommate at the time and dear friend, they're an artist and their sister is a scientist. And I'm like, what is this pattern that I'm noticing?
Mm.
And let me look a little more into that. And that was initially how I came across In the Beauty That Is Jay Stiller of the Leonardo Journal for MIT Press that I later published in. Was I got kind of obsessed with the publication. It's all about the overlaps of science and art. So that was sort of my personal trajectory and sort of how I then, you know, delved into some research to see what the wider world had thought about these ideas. And that then it just kind of all unraveled or wove together. I'm not sure, you know, which one, but I'll get a both, I guess.
You're listening to Art on the Air on WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul. Now back to our interview with Katie Glusica.
Well, that's so fascinating to me. I mean, just like as a general concept, I mean, because you're talking about some really heady stuff, and I think that, and I will say this, is like when I saw your work in person for the first time, and now that I've spent some time at your website, katieglusica.com, it was almost instinctual. I was looking at the work, and even without really knowing anything about it, there is just this like really overwhelming, almost like complexity about it. And I think that this is one of those cases where, and if you as a viewer like know what you've got going on inside your head beyond the piece, it just makes it just all the more fascinating. And I just like, I just love knowing that there's that connection between those two things. I mean, and just kind of the research that's going into your work. How much are you thinking about that kind of stuff when you're sitting down, like getting ready to work
on a
piece?
A lot. Well, I mean, sometimes it's thinking about it while I'm making it. But you know how the moments of the creative process happen kind of wildly. And
well, let me ask you, let me take this in a little bit of a different direction, because, you know, you're talking about your process, right? And you're talking about doing math and physics, and the physics side of it is glass blowing, and the math side of it is your fiber classes and specifically weaving. But I kind of want to ask very specifically weaving, because you have an MFA from SCAD with a focus in weaving. You have a BFA in crafts from Virginia Commonwealth University, VCU in Richmond, and that was a focus in weaving. What does weaving mean? Like, describe that as an artistic medium, because I think that a lot of people, like myself, might think of weaving in a very sort of functional way. So talk a little bit about, like, what that specifically means to you and to my listening audience that isn't maybe as familiar with fiber arts and weaving as a method of fiber arts.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great place to start. You know, to reference what you're saying about the sort of getting into the deeper layers of like what's going on in my head that goes into these pieces, it's like one of the first things that I want the viewer to have access to is what is weaving. So my work is very much the woven cloth on your jeans or on your blanket under a microscope, right? Kind of magnified so that you can see how it's not just this one piece of cloth, but it's all of these many, many threads interlacing with each other and coming together and to make this whole overall thing. And because of the Industrial Revolution, like even though this was something every culture throughout time did, develop weaving, the Jacquard loom was invented and textiles go from, you know, being as like more valuable than gold to what we have now. You can get a, you know, $1 t-shirt. That's another conversation, how those happen. That's a bad thing. But the $1 t-shirt. But so the knowledge of the basic knowledge of how what the process of weaving is no longer knowledge that we all have, like you just said, and but it is still this word, these words that we use metaphorically in language to describe, you know, the tapestry of our lives, the fabric of society, weave a story together. But how rich does that metaphor stay if we don't really know that process that it's referring to? So to answer the question is that weaving with woven fibers, there are two directions kind of you can go if we start at the very top, and it's you can go into what we refer to as the structure side of the fibers world or the surface design version of the fibers world. And so structure, that's where I went, and that will be weaving, knitting, crochet, felt, where you're actually making cloth. And what makes weaving different from, say, crochet or knitting, which are single element processes where you take one thread and you loop it continuously around itself in different ways to amass cloth. Weaving is a two-element process. So you have to have first a warp. Your warp threads are what go on the loom first, and they are put under tension so that they go from being wavy, wavy threads into straight lines. And then you weave the wefts in the second element perpendicularly to those warps, and over, under, interlacing all of them. And then those wefts pack on top and interact with the warps in different ways, and you can make different patterns and different structures and end up in this whole cloth. And one of the reasons that weaving in particular became such an apt metaphor is in a way because it becomes many intersections of warp and weft. And so the Jacquard loom also led to the computer directly. And now we all understand computers and pixels and how images are built on screens and grids of single points of different colors, right? And that makes this overall collective image. And when I started 15, 17 years ago, I didn't know anything about computers, but now everybody does. So it's an easy kind of gateway to even help it click, I think, for people what weaving is if you think about how the grid of pixels creates an image, it's this, the very same thing. So now you've taken all of these wavy threads and you've, using tension and order and sequence, created a grid, right? Mm. And so that starts to be where I pull the metaphor that goes into my work, which is about wave-particle duality and really non-dualities in general of how things are one thing and another thing at the same time, which is a very important concept in quantum theory or a moment when a lot of research, there's a lot of still debate about what does this mean, right? And so when I started learning more about particularly wave-particle duality, because it was a simple kind of thing, I'm not a physicist, I, as an artist, am coming to scientific ideas with an aptitude for understanding, but much more interested in, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're in our society, we're very quick to come up with new technologies and new sciences, or, you know, scientific discoveries and statistics, but and commodify it and put it out there, but very infrequently to never stop and wonder what the greater implications of this discovery of the natural world that we made, like, how does that reflect to us, and what could we learn about how we live on the planet through that observation? And so I got very engaged and curious with this idea of how when we're observing energy at a subatomic level, that both our observation of it affects it changes, it can affect. And there's a lot of dispute in the physics world about, too, what that means about what we can understand about the world and why. That will get a little confusing, I think, to interject here, but that generally, but basically, when we're trying to observe the behavior of subatomic matter, we realize there's somehow we impact how it's perceived. And so when we look at this subatomic particle, it will appear as either a wave or a particle, depending on how we look at it, but it's really both at the same time. And that idea, to me, was just totally mind-blowing, right? Like, it's so alien to everything that we experience in a day-to-day life, but taking that question a step further, how does that, you know, we have a lot of dichotomies and polarities and very, you know, black and white thinking. I mean, to be very, like, literal right now in the times, and we don't, these things are very useful tools, and we love to set things aside and make them different and say, that's that over there, and this is over here, but what does it mean if it's not? and how does that open our ability to see things more similarly than always different, and see differences as more of points of reference, not absolutes. And so thinking more and more about that, and then I was sort of spacing out one day looking at a manufactured piece of waffle weave cloth, which always has been one of my favorite weave structures, and it just dawned on me when I was looking at this fabric that I was simultaneously looking at these little sections of plain weave that visually appear as little points on grids, right? Like the warps and wefts are all tightly packed together, over under, and it's a grid, and that's what you're seeing. And coming out of that little section are these slopes of the wefts and warps over to the next section of plain weave. And I just was sort of mesmerized myself with this realization that I am looking at something right now that is simultaneously this grid of individualized points, but also a collection of waves. And that pretty much just sent me on the trajectory that I was. And I actually kind of told this story in reverse, because that happened first, and really a lot of those other thoughts came out of that experience. But it was, you know, sort of that combination of knowledges, right? That, like, reading about this thing in physics and then also understanding weaving, and then being able to make that connection between those two seemingly disparate things. And that, to me, you know, when we talk about creativity, a lot of times to artists, we say we're the creative, but I kind of have some dispute with that term sometimes, because really we need creativity in almost everything, right? Like, great science requires great creativity and breaking rules and being open to the unexpected. And when we start realizing that, like, whether I'm an artist or a scientist, it's knowing a little bit more about what I'm thinking about in the world, or what my goal of understanding is, right? If it's the scientist who wants to understand how that works, right, or what that thing looks like that we can't see but is there, and they bring that out, and they have to be very creative in the process, and then maybe it's the artist's job to do it, just our nature, right? Like, what does that mean? You know, sort of observe, and then observe that possible fact of our reality from other perceptions and perspectives. And so I think that's where I think the real power, you know, comes with crossing disciplines and realizing we made up those rules to begin with. You know, we called that science and this, that, you know, we're allowed to break them too.
You're listening to Art on the Air on WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul. Now back to our interview with Katie Glusica.
That's so fascinating to me. What I think is really interesting, and I kind of want to draw it back, you're describing this in a very heady way. So you've done a lot of research, and there is all of this background material that goes into making your work. But also, a viewer can walk up to an exhibition you're having or see a piece you've done and say, wow, that's really beautiful, right? So, like, without knowing any of that, right? So, like, you don't even need to have that background. And I'm curious, because you do have the, you know, the artistic part of you, is that important to you? Or is this just the beauty that is in the work that you create? Is it just the result of you following a specific process? Or are you thinking about it from that kind of more traditional artist standpoint, even though you're saying, you know, there's creativity in all of these, in whatever you might find, and maybe those lines aren't quite as well defined, still you're putting the work up in an art gallery. So there is that definition comes into play, right? Do you think about that? I mean, or is it just like, I'm doing this process, the result is what it is, or I'm doing this process, but I'm also kind of thinking about, hey, there is something at the end of the line of this where somebody is going to look at this and it needs to stand on its own without knowing all of this detailed background information.
Yeah, So I love this question. I think it's a really important art question. And it comes up in fibers a lot because we can make very beautiful things, and they are just that, right? And they have utility in our lives. But for me, the process is very much the last part that you said, that it's not happenstance. I really, you know, even like this interview will go out into the world as it is, right? You'll edit it, and they'll go out there, and then that's what it'll be forever. And so the same goes with any other type of art, like we're doing art right now, I think. But you have, the viewer is kind of the reason, right? So it's like I'm going to create a conversation. And so knowing that what I'm thinking about is how you put it, the heady, like not everybody wants to even go there. Right? That's not of interest to everybody necessarily. But the first mission is weaving and sharing that. And so that's why I make the fabrics very open. To me, the gallery setting is about space and time to think. And it means different things to different people. It's not to me like this elevated space, this special space that only certain people go. But I think art really is it should be free for everyone. You know, it's about bringing people together and sharing experiences, I think, and empathy in a lot of ways, and pain and everything. And so that space, to me, the galleries is about taking out all the other distractions away. So then you have this moment to reflect and observe as anybody, like kind of be the artist for a second. So with that in mind, when I'm thinking, well, how do I get somebody to engage with a piece of cloth that is so ubiquitous in life that they don't even think about anymore? And I want to show them that it's actually this magical kind of human ingenuity, and that it is beautiful. And so the beauty is in part, I'd say, a tool. I mean, it's reflective of how I feel about what I'm making and what I'm thinking, but it is a tool in a sense to bring you a little step closer. And if you want to keep going further, then there's lots more to go into. But you know, one of the most satisfying moments I've had, I really like when I get to be in the space with the work and people viewing it, and I learn from the people's responses so much. You know, it's kind of the most raw critique you could ever get, for better or worse. Sometimes it's always honest. And this gentleman, this was in Mesa, Arizona, at an exhibition I did that was collaborative with a paper cutter and a ceramicist and a sound musician, and called Making Waves. And the space was very, you know, it was a museum gallery space, so, you know, people are walking around, and there's this very different feeling in our gallery. And I see this gentleman, and he is looking at this piece and has some questions he wants to ask, where I have this sort of section that's very densely woven kitchen line that's clear, so you can see that, and that's the weft, and then you can see the warp threads coming through that, and then at the end of that section, it changes into this waffle weave with mohair, and he was letting me know that he could see that these threads move into this section and then make that, and it's all the same threads, and was just as impressed as I always am. I was like, that's so amazing how it's all one thing, but it looks so different on the same piece of cloth, which I think is a lot of rich metaphor too. But so from me, it was like he was understanding weaving at just that surface enough level to understand that this cloth is really made up of all these many other parts, and how they move together differently makes it look very different. And to me, that just really felt really special. I felt like I did my job, my first job as the artist, to share that thing, even I didn't tell him that.
You're listening to Art on the Air on WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul. I am your host, Rob Hessler. We're going to take a short break from our interview with Katie Glusica for a couple of short messages, but we will be right back.
This is a message from the Georgia State Department of Public Health, Social distancing means minimizing contact with people. It also means that if you are near someone in public, try to stay at least 6 feet away. The less contact people have with one another means the less opportunity for the virus to spread. Slowing the spread of the virus means that we can keep our healthcare system from becoming overwhelmed. More information can be found at dph.georgia.gov.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different, listener-supported, and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
Wilderness Southeast offers a variety of programs each month, including guided trips with naturalists. The organization's goal is to develop appreciation, understanding, stewardship, and enjoyment of the natural world. More information is available by calling 912-236-8115.
You're listening to Art on the Air. Now back to our interview with Katie Glusica.
No, I totally get that. Actually, you know, I had a similar experience at your exhibition. And maybe this was part of the exhibition. This was last September, so it's been about, you know, it's been about a year now since you had this exhibition. So I'm, you know, kind of forgetting all of the details of what was going on there. But I remember that your work was hanging in the gallery, and something that I really loved about it was the light going through your work and leave it, like, it was like the shadow, but it was also the light was being manipulated by your piece, and kind of like shadow, but also like a shimmery, almost like reflection on the wall. And I know that sounds maybe kind of crazy, but that, like, I remember seeing that, you know? Yeah. So when I saw that in the exhibition, I remember seeing that in the exhibition, I was like fascinated by that. I actually went back. I went to the exhibition twice because the first time I came in, it was really crowded, and I wanted to go back when it had kind of cleared out, and there was, like, I could really see that part of it, you know? And so, like, I do think that that's a really, you know, I think you make a good point of that person kind of finding something deeper, and I mean, like, in an intuitive way, instead of having a long discussion with you or reading all of the background material that you, you know, reference in making your work. I think there's value. There's a lot of value in that. And that, I think that does show that you are doing your job. And that's hard, actually. That's a really hard thing as an artist, right? Especially when you're doing complicated work.
Yeah. And another kind of funny note, because I almost feel like the experience you described having, and what I think one of the most powerful things art can do, is let you feel my feelings. And what you just described is very, like, that kind of curiosity of, like, that and this over here and this and that over there, like, that's very much how my mind works.
I want people to,
in a sense.
Yeah, I want people to look at art that way in general. You know, like, as somebody who is an art lover, like, I love going to shows, and, like, I think once people, you know, as art viewers, if you just open your mind to the possibilities of what you're looking at, right? There's so much there. There's so much going on. And that's one thing I've definitely learned from, you know, just interviewing so many, you know, hundreds of artists now over the last couple of years, is things that I didn't even really, that I just totally took for granted and overlooked. Like, I can find really interesting things in. And so, yeah, I definitely had that experience with your work. But look, we've been talking for a really long time now, actually. So I have a couple of questions for you that I don't want to let go. I want to get to, because I thought that these are sort of interesting things, and I think it relates. And one is that, you know, in addition to doing your fine art weaving, you have been doing a lot of restoration work, and this has been a part of your process for years now, but you've been doing, especially recently, I've seen, you know, on Instagram and on Facebook, you've done some restoration work. Do you see a line between those things, between, like, fine art and doing restoration work with weaving?
I do. So when I learned how to weave, I also started learning how to restore Persian rugs. So I had done a couple weaving classes, and then went after this gig at the rug shop, who would look for weavers. And from the very beginning, it wasn't a wasn't a very, like, popular thing back then. Like, one of the other kids was sort of interested in doing it. Her teacher wasn't particularly interested, but totally supportive and encouraging. So it's kind of a multi-layer relationship for me. They're two sides of my same practice, for sure, like the fine art making and restoration. And I'm very fortunate, I think. It's not easy to be an artist by any measure, but I still am very grateful every day for those choices and however I got where I'm at. But it's also, in that way, like, there's something, there are different ways of thinking about the same process. That's, I think, what is probably the most succinct way to put it, that feed off each other and inform each other. And one of the things that's always been kind of an automatic process for me is sort of in between making more, you know, fine art or complex art, like for the exhibition you saw, I like a technical challenge, right? So only because technically the weave structure that I use in all of those pieces, they're technically very simple. And it's such, like, super simple stuff, in a way, what I'm doing. And I think that's a big part of, like, how do you take in art these complex ideas and pick them apart and diffuse them into the most simple form. And I think by continuing to give myself technical challenges that expand my knowledge and understanding of weaving ever further helps me simplify things in a way. Like, the more complex my knowledge is, the more simply I can diffuse it out to others. And the restoration work, which is a huge part of, like, a personal life mission, if you will. Like, I really, truly believe in repairing things, making things that can be repaired, reusing things until they're done. I think it's really the most truly sustainable approach to living, is to keep what we have and take care of it. And I think the respect that is generated when we take that approach, right, like treating those objects with respect, is like really important, I think, as an idea in life and how we treat all animate and inanimate things and our relationship to the whole world, one with respect. And so I feel like that, like, restoring things is like a part of a larger mission, as well as also fulfilling a lot of technical curiosity challenges that I crave and need for my rest of my practice. So I've been doing rug restoration for 15, 16 years, and then just the last year or so, about 2 years probably, been getting into the wicker. I've really gotten proficient in caning. And, you know, well, really any kind of weaving with the seeds. And that's so I've, like, even expanded my technical skills in the restoration part of the process. But so, because when you're building something from new versus when you're fixing something that exists, there's this, you have to put it into the mindset of the person who made the thing that you're fixing, right? Because when things are made by hand, there's imperfection, right? There's their hand that was there, and then other repairs that have been done to the piece, like, you build this whole history into it. And that experience of adding your hand into this history of all these other hands that have put on this object, it also makes the world, like, the whole meaning of art, I think, in connecting the whole purpose and meaning of making new objects more meaningful to me. I make a lot less new objects than objects I repair also.
Mm.
And I don't know if this is kind of a silly thing, but there's this book, The Gold Sense, that I recently read, and there's a last sentence in it that I think just really sums kind of my feelings about restoration work up. So the book was, I was really enthralled, and it had a lot to do with antiques and restoration and paintings and life. And so it's the last paragraph. It says, whatever teaches us to talk to ourselves is important, whatever teaches us to sing ourselves out of despair. But the painting has also taught me that we can speak to each other across time. And I feel I have something very serious and urgent to say to you, my non-existent reader, and I feel I should say it as urgently as if I were standing in the room with you. That life, whatever else it is short. that fate is cruel, but maybe not random. The nature, meaning death, always wins, but that doesn't mean we have to bow and buckle to it. But maybe even if we're not always so glad to be here, it's our task to immerse ourselves anyway, wade straight through it, right through the cesspool, while keeping eyes and hearts open. And in the midst of our dying, we rise from the organic and sink back ignominiously into the organic. It is a glory and privilege to love what death doesn't touch. For if disaster and oblivion have followed this painting down through time, so too has love. Insofar as it is immortal, and it is, I have a small, bright, immutable part of that immortality. It exists, and it keeps on existing, and I add my own love to the history of people who have loved beautiful things and looked out for them and pulled them from the fire and sought them when they were lost and tried to preserve them and save them while passing them along, literally from hand to hand, singing out brilliantly from the wreck of time to the next generation of lovers in the night.
Beautifully said there, Katie Glusicka. Now, if people want to get to know more about you and your work, where can they see what you're up to?
So, katieglusicka.com, as you've mentioned, finally, is a great place. I'm on Instagram by the same handle. That's one thing I'm very easy to find. If you just put Katie Glusicka in the old Google it up, it'll show you pretty much everything I'm up to. I'm the only one on there so far.
Very cool. Well, Katie Glusicka, thank you so much for spending some time talking with me for Art on the Air today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob. This is really fun. I appreciate it, too.
You're listening to Art on the Air with your host, Rob Hessler, on WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
So, what are we really made of? Dig deep inside the atom and you'll find tiny particles held together by invisible forces. Everything is made up of tiny packets of energy born in cosmic furnaces.
The atoms that we're made of have negatively charged electrons whirling around a big bulky nucleus. The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story. Suppose that little things behaved very differently than anything big. Nothing's really as it seems. It's so wonderfully different than anything big. The world is a dynamic mess of jingling things. It's hard to believe.
The quantum theory is so strange and bizarre. Even Einstein couldn't get his head around it.
In the quantum world, the world of particles, nothing is certain. It's a world of probabilities.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
All crazy things that things really are like.
Electrons act like waves. No, they don't exactly. They act like particles. No, they don't exactly.
We need a theory of everything. Which is still just beyond our grasp. We need a theory of everything. Perhaps the ultimate triumph. The ultimate triumph of science.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
I gotta stop somewhere. I'll leave you something to imagine.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
Welcome back to Art on the Air. I am Rob Hessler here with my co-host, Gretchen Hilmers.
With you as always, Gretchen Hilmers.
With you as always. You're listening to us here on WRUULP Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Sounding Community Radio with Global Soul. You just heard the amazing song, Weird Science, by Oingo Boingo.
Oh my God, that movie is amazing.
I love it. It's one of my favorite movies, like growing up as a kid. I loved that movie.
Chet turns into this big toad-like thing.
Doesn't he turn into a...
It's a toad.
Isn't it?
It's like a man-toad.
Isn't it like poop or something? I don't know.
It might be a pile of... No, he eats a fly.
All right, you're probably right about that. And before that, we played the song The Quantum World by Symphony of Science. That is a very weird song, but I thought that it was very appropriate. And of course, this all relates to our guest for this week, which was Katie Glusica, who is very interested in science in her work. And so we're going to play another little snippet of Katie right now, a little snippet about her organizational system, because we're going to talk organization. Let's listen in. Talk to me about lists, drawers, and post-it notes.
I'd be more than happy to. I have a lot of them. Actually, I think that's a perfect question, because I think my brain can be a little chaotic sometimes in terms of how it thinks. So I can't really function without writing things down. I think I'm also a very kinetic person, is that the word? Where, you know, if I do something while I'm saying, you know, if I write it down, I'll remember it, as opposed to just trying to remember it. So I have this sort of, what I think of, and it is highly disputed, sort of beautiful, organized version of chaos that is post-it notes. And same inside all the drawers where I have things I know. You know, I have these rules about what this drawer is for, and, you know, like a tool drawer, I have like a fasteners drawer, that's where tapes and staple guns go, and then there's pencils and paint, you know, so it very much reflects my love of weaving and studio practice and making systems, which is kind of what it is. It's how, the only way I can function is to have sort of habitual systems I can lean on to order my inner wild brain.
And that was a little bonus question and recording with Katie Glusica talking about her organizational style. And we're going to talk about studio organization here for a couple minutes now. Oh, I'm not an expert at this because my studio space is a nightmare right now.
But that's okay, because I organize for us. It's kind of my thing. I love me some label making.
I was about to say that, like, label maker is your thing.
It's my jam.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of artists are the types who are like, I found this thing and one day I'm going to use it, right? And so then you do that like 100 times and you have quite a few things.
A wall of art supplies.
So I was supposed to do an exhibition at the end of last year that fell through. And so I collected all of these huge...
A wall of TVs?
Yeah, all of these huge old black tube televisions, and I literally have created a wall out of them now.
Oh my god.
You know, what can I say? I mean, I still want to do that project, so I gotta keep them. But yeah, I mean, it's organizational style, and I really liked how Katie was talking about using, you know, post-it notes and drawers and how she organizes everything, because it helps her work within her brain by having things organized, like knowing exactly where everything is. I'm kind of the opposite, that I like things to be organized and cleaned up, but I also like them to be a little bit chaotic, so that way that they become like, I can look at something and be like inspired by it, because it's just like sitting there and it's weird.
Right, and I think that's also a different kind of organization. It's the way that I like to also organize, but inside the house. And you like to call it, Gretchen, where is this? And it's not in the place where it's supposed to be, but I know where it is usually.
You know, you're a mom now, and that's like kind of a thing. Like, you always know where stuff, mom always knows where stuff is.
That's a good thing, because dad don't.
No, that is true. I do not know. But I mean, I think that the studio organizational, it's really interesting. Like, I've had the chance to go to a lot of people's studios and see how different people do things differently. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, there's such a wide range of possibilities. Like, I think of one artist who I love, Matt Tool, and I've been to his studio, and it's this insane shop with all of this stuff, but it does have an organization that works for Matt, and it's really cool. And then you look at somebody like Jennifer Moss's studio over at Sulfur Studios, and hers is much more organized. It's smaller. She's got things like in everything in its place. And she's actually a weaver too. So.
And Jose Rey actually just did a Facebook story where he's showing what he's working on. But what I really like about it is you kind of get a peek inside of his studio space. Maybe we should ask artists to do virtual studio space tours.
That's actually not a bad idea. And I think what's cool, though, that you mentioned that Jose, because Jose's studio is in his house. And it's like right inside his front door. You walk in and his studio begins. So organization for him is super important, because he's living amongst it. And like, if that was a nightmare, you would not want to be in there. But of course, Jose's work is like really vibrant and beautiful and fun. So
it's
like,
very neat in some ways.
Yeah. So yeah, it fits. And he's a musician, beautiful. So he's got like kind of music-y stuff all around too. So music-y it's a great stuff. Vibe.
Is that the technical term?
Yeah, that's a technical term from what I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Jose told me that.
Oh, okay.
Jose did not tell me that. Really interesting, though. But it was great to have Katie on, and we'd love to hear any of your stories about your studios. And maybe we'll try to talk about some of those things. Maybe I should do a couple of interviews. But anyway, that brings us to the end of another episode of Art on the Air. We thank you for joining us. If you're listening to the live show, we've got some of that old Savannah magic coming up next. But we're not quite done. We're going to play one more song.
She blinded me with science.
Good song to finish off this show. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week. All the time we have for this week's episode of Art on the Air with your host, Rob Hessler. Listen every Wednesday for our live show, broadcasting from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on 107.5 FM Savannah Soundings and worldwide at WRUU.org. And you can catch past episodes on the WRUU station archives on our website, as well as on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher.
We'll talk to you next week, where we'll have another batch of art on the air.